And so I just wanted you to know that this is where the text is found. It's in Deuteronomy 20. And so I'm going to read from the KJV. I apologize because that's all I have on this one at the moment. In the process, because this is where you read from, I'll show you. All right, so I'll start at verse 10. When you come near unto a city to fight against it, then proclaim peace unto it. And it shall be, if it make the answer of peace and open unto you, then it shall be that all the people that is found therein shall be tributaries unto thee, and they shall serve thee. And if it will make no peace with thee, but will make war against thee, then you shall besiege it. And when the Lord your God has delivered it into your hands, you shall smite every male thereof with the edge of the sword. That's when you were like, oh, that's correct. See, it's only referring to the males. But then it continues. But the women and the little ones and the cattle and all that is in the city, this is in Deuteronomy 20, verse 14. But the women and the little ones and the cattle and all that is in the city, even all the spoil thereof, shall you take unto yourself, and you shall eat the spoil of your enemies, which the Lord your God has given you. Verse 15, then you shall do unto all the cities which are very far off from you, which are not of the cities of these nations, but of the cities of these people. Now it switches to something different, which the Lord your God does give you for an inheritance. You shall save alive nothing that breathes, but you shall utterly destroy them, namely the Hittites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, and the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, as the Lord your God has commanded you. And all the commentaries that are consulted, it states here that it's every man, woman, child, animal, etc. So everything that breathes is to be destroyed. And one of the nations there was mentioned was the Canaanites. So I remembered that you were saying, oh, it's only the males. And I was going, man, for some reason, that just didn't stick right with me. So I went and looked, because you made me a good Berean. And I went and I looked and I was like, oh, I see where you got that text from, where it was only the males. And then as it continues, it says for all of these nations, the Hittites, the Hivites, and the Canaanites. Well, so it's everything that breathes.
Dennis was talking Numbers 31.
What do you think?
So Numbers 31 does make that distinction of, now it fits in category one, but it does say every woman who has not known a man by sleeping with him, save for unto yourselves. So I think that was the verse he was pulling up. But the point that you're bringing up is the foundation from which it all builds. So I agree. That's good. Thank you.
But what do you think they had in mind for all those women who had never slept with a man?
What do I think that they had in mind? What do you mean?
His question is, can they be made?
He said, save all those women who have not slept with a man. What do you?
That I don't know.
Yeah, don't know.
Make a pretty good guess, though.
So the question is, can a conquering Israelite who lives under the law take a female spoil of war and treat her like a sex slave? That's basically the insinuation you're making.
The answer to that is actually no.
Right.
That everybody who's taken, they have rights. So, in other words, the equivalent that I usually give when I debate with other people regarding these points is quite simply this. So, I don't know how many people here who's joined, like, the military or anything like that, but you can't just walk off a base. You go AWOL, you're going to end up in, like, deep, deep trouble. So, in a sense, true, we don't call it slavery, but the slavery that you see in the Hebrew Bible is akin to a person joining the military, and basically, true, you have rights in the military, but you don't have a right just to walk off the base.
Well, I'll say what we say in the military. We take away your rights and we ration them back to you as privileges. So that's the American military version.
But all these cities were destroyed on warrant of God. What do you think the people of these cities felt like when people just march in and say, okay, it's our God or no God, and if you don't, we're going to kill you all.
So what do I think that they felt?
What would you expect them to do? Just, okay, fine, lay down their arms and...
Oh, so I'll answer it this way. In the Hebrew Bible, we have a prophet named Jeremiah. There's another guy, I can't remember his name at the moment, that'll come to me. There was another prophet that was prophesying to the king of Judah at the same time. Both of these guys were. Jeremiah was telling the people of Israel, lay down all of your weapons, do all of this. The Lord your God tells you to do all of that. Put down your weapons because Babylon is coming and they're going to take you captive and they're going to carry you away. This other prophet came and said, this guy Jeremiah, he's full of hooey. Let me tell you, God tells all of you and you, Mr. King, to go ahead and get all your arms together, grab all your children and the women, put weapons in their hands because we are the people of Israel and we are not going to go down. No way, no way. So if I ask you right now, is Jeremiah a false prophet? No, he's actually the true prophet. So the people of Israel actually sided with the person who was politically correct here because they felt that, what, our God, the covenant maker with the people of Judah and Israel, he's actually going to do this? So I think that the people of Judah and Israel felt the same way that these Canaanites and Hivites and all this kind of stuff were like, this is just messed up. So I would agree with you. Yeah, it's messed up. Why, right? Why? I think that they felt terribly horrible, you know, and it was just bad. I mean, you were asking me, how do I think that they felt? That's how I think that they felt.
But let's put it in modern context.
When is the defensive war, you know, they're going to defend themselves against Babylon if Babylon invades. But this is where they're on the offensive. They just go in and...
Well, Dennis, let's put it in modern context. Do you think that we're wrong? Well, we're on the same team on this one. We're defending the same turf. The Old Testament scripture for the Jew is scripture for the Christian. So,
Sometimes.
All the time. So the question is this. Let's use ISIS as an example right now. Are we morally justified when ISIS, by the way, many of whom live in those same towns and came from those same towns, and some of whom do invade, are we morally okay to wipe them off the map with a 2,000-pound GBU? Or do you want to ask us how ISIS feels about that?
You are actually analogizing the invasion of...
No, in fact,
ISIS?
ISIS are orders of magnitude more preferable morally than the people that living in Canaan at this time who sacrificed their very children on the altar of the god Molech and other ones. So I would rather be neighbors with an ISIS guy than I would with the people who are under judgment by God in this point. Remember, he held off the nation of Israel in slavery for 500 years to give them time to basically get over it, to quote-unquote, if I'm going to quote God, I should be exact, so that the sin of the Ammonites may come to fruition, to full fulfillment. So the idea is, it was not that they were not given opportunity for grace, they were given 5 centuries for that. And by the fact that they got nothing but worse and worse and worse, God levels judgment on them, a judgment that he then turns around and re-levels on the people of Israel for not following rules for breaking rules less badly than did the Canaanites because their knowledge was greater. And so thus their responsibility was greater. A point which I've made in this class before, why does Moses, people in Israel do something wrong, God seems to forgive them up to a point. Moses breaks one command, barely, basically, and gets told you're going to die outside the land. Why? His level of knowledge was that much higher, so his excuse is that much less present.
This is all premised on all this stuff being true.
Yeah, that's right.
There's a lot of evidence that there was never a single Jew ever in Egypt at that time.
I would challenge that assertion.
I'm not saying that that is a fact, but there is evidence to support the position that the Israelites were never enslaved by the Egyptians.
But here,
it's all premised on all this stuff being true, that they sacrificed their children, that they screwed their goats or whatever else you think they did. That's all based on what your Bible says.
That's not the case. It's not just based on Scripture. If you want to go back and say, ancient archaeologists, tell me about the people that lived in Canaan before the Israelites came there, they're going to tell you the same things the Bible says. That is not specific to Old Testament scripture, that is a well-known, well-attested archaeological fact. Well, secular archaeology.
So I usually challenge it with this. I really, really am into presuppositional apologetics, and I thank the Christians for this. And it works. I really do. It kind of works like this. So if they find archaeological evidence of what you just stated, here's my question to you. Will you believe now? If you said there's never been any archaeological evidence of the Jews or Israelites being slaves in Egypt and so on, and so, you know, there's no reason to believe. So my question is if they do find that evidence, will you now believe? I'll turn this in a different way.
Yes.
So
yes, I would believe that the Egyptians enslaved the Israelites and that they escaped and went to the Promised Land. Yeah.
Gotcha. So this is usually how I deal with it, like in Mormon and Evangelical, when they're doing apologetics against each other, and at least they're starting to change the model. One of the things that they would tell Latter-day Saints is hey, there's no horses here in the New World. There's no archaeological evidence for it whatsoever during the time of Nephi, right. And so on. Well, I have, from Los Angeles last year, and the La Brea Tar Pits, they started finding horses like crazy here in the New World. So if I were a Latter-day Saint, I would go, well, here's your horses, buddy. So now do you believe in the Book of Mormon, Doctrine and Covenants, Pearl of Great Price, and so on? So having that kind of a framework, if you want to do this as being, well, if evidence is the catch-all be-all, then I just find this a little bit problematic, because once that evidence is found, I hope that the person would then go ahead and accede, yes, well, now I do believe that. So it's like you said, well, at least you will believe then at that point. And it's possible. They didn't know that Troy existed. They believed that Troy was some fancy made-up thing. And then a couple of years ago, they came up and they have evidence for Troy like nobody's business. Same thing. There's a professor in Israel named Israel Finkelstein. He used to, and he's Jewish, he used to say Abraham
Israel
didn't exist.
Finkelstein is Jewish.
Yeah, Finkelstein, yeah. Yeah. Abraham didn't exist, King David didn't exist, and so on. And then the Israel Antiquities Authority is, they're the big body for antiquities in Israel, and they're watching archaeologists go through all of this stuff, and they're going, we're now finding stuff of King David's house, and they're showing it. And they're doing this in peer-reviewed journals and so on. And Israel Finkelstein, Professor Finkelstein, is now going, all right, King David existed, but just not at the level that the Bible says. He's what we call a minimalist. We have maximalist and minimalist. The minimalists go ahead and they try to downplay this stuff again and again and again. But now he went from going, King David doesn't exist, to, okay, it's reasonable to believe that King David exists. With Abraham, we found shards of his father Terah, say, for example. And they're like, what? So for the longest time, people didn't believe that Abraham was a historical figure or his dad Terah was a historical figure. Well, true, so we don't have nothing from Abraham yet, but we're starting to find stuff of Terah, where his father comes from, the Ur of the Chaldees, and all this kind of stuff. And it's kind of fascinating. So here's my thing. So if archaeological evidence just comes out one by one and all of this goes, I hope that the naysayer at that point will go, okay, well, this is what you required as evidence. Do you believe now? And I think Christians usually go, well, now you have a choice to make, if that's your standard.
Or in that same vein, after the Six-Day War, was it Ben-Gurion who was the head guy?
Okay. I don't know. I think so.
Ben-Gurion was the Secretary of Defense and the guy who was the architect of most of the Six-Day War.
Well, whoever the head of Israel was after they won the Six-Day War, which, by the way, was the coolest war in the history of
the
world.
The guy
with
the
eye patch.
Right?
Moshe Dayan.
No, he was the general.
Are you asking Yom Kippur or Six-Day?
The Six-Day War.
Okay.
Yeah, the Six-Day War.
Yeah, Moshe
whoever
Dayan.
Whoever was head of Israel said, okay, now we've got a chance. We've got the Sinai. Now we can go in there and we can find evidence for Exodus. And they looked and they looked and they looked and they found nothing.
So,
now, I'm not saying...
No, you're right. Here's the funny thing. Like, if you look at Chinese archaeology and you watch... I did this with him. It's fascinating how people are very Eurocentric. So, watch this. So, I asked him before, what's the first reference of last names
About 13th, 14th century Europe.
Awesome. Actually, the first mention of last names are Chinese and Korean. You can see Chinese last names, family names, and everything. So usually in the academy, i.e. in the universities, most things, even in Jewish studies, it's European-centered. Well, if I show you in Chinese history that when an emperor makes a command to clean something up, say, for example, they clean it up, and there will be no trace of it whatsoever. They have erased people out of books, their annals and everything. They have cleaned up evidence as best they can, and the only thing that saves us and the archaeologists is that we're all human, and we're faulty, and we're sloppy, and we make mistakes, and so therefore, people have left little bitty pieces of these places in Chinese history that we're finding, but it's not to the degree of what you would expect, because during such empires, it was vast, it was huge, and so on. And so when they said clean it up, they cleaned it up. So it's possible that the pharaohs, usually historians like Kenneth Kitchen, who's a big evangelical Christian and so on, will make mention that when a pharaoh from the Middle East, of course, makes a command, the command is pretty serious, and you're going to see hundreds of thousands of people sweeping the Sinai Desert, say, for example. What are you going to do? I mean, they're just going to sweep it.
So you're claiming that the pharaoh ordered him to clean it up so that nobody would know that they...
That's a possibility.
But here's the dilemma with your approach. If at the time when nobody knew anything about the city of Troy, everybody thought Homer was writing mere fiction, using your logic, at the time that we had not found anything from Troy, you said, hey, they've been digging for 300 years and didn't find squat. So obviously the city of Troy doesn't exist.
Well, I mean, so and obviously then, it doesn't exist. The evidence doesn't point to
right.
its existence.
But what that means, though, is then a few years later, they then found the city of Troy. So all this is the fact that the Israelis had the Sinai for a short bit, big deal. That didn't mean anything.
Well, it means something.
No, it really doesn't. In archaeology, it means very little. Because to do a thorough, how long have they been digging in Central America in American archaeology for the Mayans? What, since white Europeans have been here? And we know this much about it. It was only recently that Michael Coe was able to even read Mayan script. How come it took him 200-300 years? Gosh golly, they've been reading it for all this time. So all it is it's a very times-bound argument.
And this has
to be very weak.
All I'm saying is that the head of Israel, whoever it was, says, now we're going to find it.
And how much money did they spend? How many people did they send?
They sent Jewish archaeologists out who were primed to find it.
And how many went? Five?
In the middle of a war zone, mind you.
Five archaeologists?
I'm asking, how many went? I don't either.
So, Dennis, another thing.
I'm just saying that his absence of evidence is not...
Evidence of absence.
Right.
But the fact that they haven't found any yet sort of speaks some. It doesn't say anything about
it. So, Dennis, let me turn that argument right back around. Let's turn the argument right back around. And let's be fair. So, let me articulate the archaeological one very briefly, which is where should you expect to find evidence with a minimum of archaeological effort? In places that are long-standing cities where they live for a long period of time, which basically get built into tells in the Middle East. How much trace should you see of a 3,000-plus-year-old nomadic people who built no cities, no permanent structures? In fact, the temple to the most important structure was a tent that they built. How much of an imprint would that leave after 3,000 years?
Yeah,
okay, it would be some,
right.
But it wouldn't be minimal. So I'm not done with the point. If you also say, let's look and see, where were they for a long time? Egypt, by this story. Where were they for a long time after that? The land of Israel, by this story. Let's go look in those places. What do we see there? Oh, we've got confirmation of both of those things. Let's go even back earlier to places that people said didn't exist at all, Sodom and Gomorrah. You heard.
Actually, Dennis wasn't there that Sunday.
Oh, okay.
I never heard anybody say that those cities didn't exist.
That Sodom and Gomorrah didn't exist, that they weren't like Troy? That has been a position of archaeology for a long period of time. So at any rate, the point is this. How would you like it? Am I justified in saying this? Well, you know what? I'm not convinced by evolution, because we should see a ton of fossils prior to the Cambrian explosion, and yet here all they are. So this doesn't make any sense.
Well, you're a little bit behind in your biology because we are finding tons of pre-Cambrian fossils. However, let me just get back.
Feel free to present that paper, Dennis.
There is no solid evidence that the Exodus happened other than Scripture.
And until last year or the year before, I can't remember, there was no scholarly evidence that Krishna from Hinduism ever existed. And they just found underwater in India, they're sending divers down as we speak, right off the coast of India, an entire city on the ocean floor. And they got cameras and everything all there. And the Hindus are going, told you, okay, Krishna existed, right? But see, just because we haven't found it yet doesn't mean, you know. So there could be stuff. So do you now believe that Krishna existed? Because they have all this writings on stone and everything. So before you said, no, Krishna doesn't exist. But now that you found the city, now Krishna exists.
I wouldn't know Krishna from him. So I'm just pointing out that there is, you know, I keep making
this. No, is it reasonable not to believe this stuff? You betcha. Of course it's reasonable not to believe that. I don't think that you're stupid for not believing something because there's no evidence. So you won't experience that from me, at least. But it's also reasonable to believe that it does happen because just the opposite has been coming out to be true.
Dennis, let me challenge the facts.
Why do I have the feeling throughout all this whole day, this whole morning, that you guys, all of you, are picking on the Mormons?
Dennis, let me challenge.
I don't like Mormons.
Dennis, let me challenge the facts of what you just said. There's no evidence for the Exodus. Do you think that that's true?
I'm not talking to you.
Do you think that? Cathedra, may I regulate, man?
We're looking at.
So hold on. Let me go back 1 second. The statement, then, if Dennis isn't going to talk to me on this one, there's no evidence for the Exodus, is patently false. There's evidence for the Israelites being in Egypt at the time. There's the Ipuwer papyrus that lists many of the plagues by the Pharaoh. Now, who's the last person who's going to categorize his own defeat at the hands of a foreign god? It's the Pharaoh. You don't build monuments to your failings. And yet the Ipuwer papyrus talks about the rivers running with blood, that people can't drink from them, about all these plagues and all that kind of stuff. So you've got Israelites here in a particular time frame, and then you've got Israelites showing up in Canaan in a particular time frame. How did they get from Egypt to Canaan? Well, I think a plausible way that would have happened is that they left Egypt and exited and went to Canaan. So to say that there's no evidence for the Exodus is just not archaeologically tenable. You can't say that.
I know I'm going to regret this.
Feel free.
I know I'm going to regret this. But what does the fact that a papyrus listed some plagues in Egypt have to do with Jews being there?
Let's see if this makes sense to you. The Jewish text says Moses went to Pharaoh and that these plagues happened. And they list out these plagues. We put that data point out there. There's another completely unrelated, non-Jewish, purely Egyptian, different era papyrus that comes out that lists the same plagues. Does that mean anything to you from an academic or archaeological viewpoint?
It's possible, but it's also possible that the Jews knew about those plagues and made the story up.
Okay, that's a possibility as well.
Well,
the point is, in archaeology, this is called evidence. And you have to take the evidences and put them together. When you have two bits of evidence that corroborate an historical occurrence that are ancient, that's really, really good.
Does the papyrus have the word Jew in it?
No.
Israelite?
I'll let you research that one so that the question will make more sense to you later. But that question doesn't even make sense in this context. Okay, back to you guys.
Well, this kind of argument has
they're not known as Jews at the time.
Do you know...
Dennis, they're not called Jews at the time. That's what I mean to say.
You know what I meant.
What word would you like to look for in that Ipuwer papyrus to see if these people were there?
Kike. How about kike? Let's say kike.
Let's be respectful in this guy. You can be mean to me all you want, but not to the guests.
They know what I mean.
Okay.
You know there's a...
Guy, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just thinking this kind of argument has been going on for quite some time. You had an archaeologist by the name of Layard back in the 1940s and 50s. And up until that time, the skeptics were saying, hey, you know what? The Bible talks about this Assyrian race, and it's not possible that they're not here. Because even though the documents, you know, the Old Testament and whatnot says that the Assyrian race existed, we haven't found any archaeological evidence to support it, therefore the Bible's lying. And then along comes this guy, Layard, and he finds the entire city of Nineveh. Now all of a sudden they had to go back and say, oh, you know what, I guess the Bible was telling the truth. So what we have here are two different types of evidence. You've got evidence, eyewitness evidence, historical evidence that's judged by a certain types of tests and criteria. And then you have archaeological evidence, which is great for either corroborating or disputing the evidence that's claimed in the documents. But the absence of archaeological evidence for particular people, places, and events in history does not mean that those people, places, and events in history were not there or did not happen. It just means you don't have this particular type of evidence. You still have the eyewitness testimonies. And then you have to apply tests to determine, am I being lied to? Is this true? Has this come to us through time, you know, accurately translated, etc.? But the absence of archaeological evidence does not either corroborate or disprove it. It's just simply not available.
That's the point I was trying to make.
Right. You said you can't confirm by the lack of that archaeological evidence that the eyewitness testimony is false.
I didn't.
Okay.
I just said there's no archaeological evidence.
Well, I'll tell you what's crazy. So,
You know I wasn't calling you guys kites.
Yeah, yeah, don't worry.
This guy just pushes buttons on me that I have no filter.
There seems to be in the academy and the university this double standard, which is this. When we talk about the Judeo-Christian, looking at any of Judeo-Christian literature claims or whatever, the standard is placed at like a 10. From a level of 1 to 10, they place it at the highest as a 10. So watch this. So in Hindu literature, the Bhagavad Gita, Upanishads, and so on, what is the earliest recorded that you read recently that we have of those things?
It's in the 1400 AD.
1400 AD, but yet you'll watch the scholars in the universities, UCLA, UC Berkeley, and so on, go, these are some of the oldest religious texts that we have in the world. In fact, if you look at any timeline, you will see all of those first, and then you'll see the Bible and the Torah and everything down here, but you're telling me that the earliest evidence that we have of any of this, any written evidence, is way down here, but yet they place it up here? It's the double standard that they play with all Judeo-Christian type stuff in the university. And it drives me crazy, but that's what they do.
You know, there's a story about this guy is going up the hill to the pearly gates. I think some of the people in here have heard this. He's going up the hill to the pearly gates, and he's all excited. He's going to get judged. He's going to get to heaven. And you see the gates up there with this guy in the beard, but there's a guy walking down the hill with a big frown on his face. And the guy going up the hill says, "What's the problem?" He says, "The Mormons were right."
Steve, you got a question?
How do you know that you are right? How does Scott know that Christians are right? How do the Hindus know they're right?
Actually, let's ask a great question. How do you know you're right about there not being a God?
I don't say there's not a God.
Okay,
there's no evidence for a God.
Do you believe in a God?
Hmm?
Do you believe in a God?
I don't believe in a God because I don't see the evidence for a God.
Okay, have we offered you stuff that is evidence, i.e. scriptures,
no.
That so archaeology, the arguments of like cosmological argument, which you agree with?
I do not agree with it.
You've accepted both statements in the conclusion, right? Did you not accept both statements in the conclusion?
Of what?
The cosmological argument. You didn't?
No.
Okay, well, everybody in this class has heard you do it multiple times. So let me ask you.
I lied.
Okay.
Dennis, how are we supposed to take you seriously?
Yeah. You keep shifting the ground all the time. Your standard is never consistent. And in fact, the email exchange on the moral problem is probably the number one thing. It's either subjective or it's objective. You got to pick terrain and you got to defend it. These guys are picking terrain and defending it. We're picking terrain and defending it. At some point, you do have a belief system. You need to be able to defend it. Or you need to articulate that I just have no idea, which is fine, too. If that's what you're saying, that's fine, too. Steve, you had a question, and then Nat.
Yeah, you're talking about the Torah, and you hold that to a pretty high not as truth.
Holding the Torah up pretty high that is
a
truth.
As a truth. We hold the Torah high as a truth.
Absolutely. Yes, we do.
Yes.
So what truth in your words truth, and how did you come to that point?
How did you come to believe that the Torah is true?
How did we come to that conclusion that we believe that the Torah is true? Well, actually, two. One is that I believe in a tradition that's been given to me. Yes?
Yep.
The second one is this usually sounds silly to people, but I'll say it this way. Usually evangelical Christians relate to this very easily. It's that I intuit that it's true. Almost like what you would find in natural law. So in natural law, I don't need something to tell me not to beat him up. I already know in natural law I shouldn't steal from him, I shouldn't beat him up. In fact, in the biblical text itself, there's no command not to murder or kill or anything. And who gets in trouble? Cain kills Abel, and he's held accountable for it. So most people who subscribe to like natural law and stuff like that, they say the reason why is because God placed an intuition in you. So what happens with me is that when I read the Torah text, I feel something from it and I intuit that it is in fact a divine text. But of course, for an atheist, that's not proof of something, but you're asking me personally and I intuit it. If I read the Psalms or Proverbs, I have a very deep feeling or connection to it.
Can I take this one?
No, go ahead.
The story earlier this morning that it wasn't that the burden of truth is on the person that makes the claim.
Right.
So you're saying, well, the Orthodox Jews don't believe that Jesus is the Messiah because you don't have proof. So, what is your proof that I should believe that the Torah is
right? So, if we hold it to this high standard, and as you said when you were presenting the Ten Commandments of, you know, debate,
right,
that the person who's making the claim has the burden of proof.
Yeah.
How do you how do you maintain that burden of proof for the claim that the Torah is that truth?
Oh, I don't. So, like, say, for example, if I were to speak honestly about what my certitude levels are on God, the Torah, and stuff like that, I don't know if you guys have ever seen it. There's
a thing
that goes like this.
Very well.
There's one here, 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 here. So we have Gnostic theism and agnostic theism. We have Gnostic atheism and agnostic atheism, right? So what do I mean by Gnostic and agnostic? Not the normal religious terms. What I mean by Gnostic is knowledge. I know. I know that no God exists, or I know that God exists. So I am an agnostic theist. So if somebody were to be a Gnostic atheist saying, I know no God exists, oh boy, they just put their level up here, and I would submit to them, come on, man. For you to be a Gnostic atheist, that means that you would have all the power and all the knowledge available to you to know, beginning from end, that no God exists and so on. The tenable place is to be an agnostic atheist. So a Gnostic theist, say, for example, might be a charismatic Christian. Hey, I speak in tongues, and therefore I know that God exists. Well, that's not proof for anybody. That's proof for him as an individual, but it's not proof, you know, for the outside world or so on. They may believe it is, but I would submit to you that it's not. So I myself, while it's true, I believe that the Torah is this. I do believe it's divine. I don't know that it's true, and I don't know that it's divine. I only intuit these things, and I believe those things. So my certitude isn't at 100%. It's like, you know, 90, 80, you know, going down in that kind of a range.
So with your permission, I'll reattack with two quick ones and then to Carl. If you're going to default to intuition as being your arbiter of judgment, what do you say to somebody else whose intuition leads them to believe in Mormonism or Christianity or Hinduism?
Right, right. So with that, it's a good question. There is not much that I can say to them except I am not persuaded by their arguments. Let me give you a good one.
You will not be persuaded by their arguments because you've already said intuition is the method of judgment, not analysis of evidence. So you need not even say that. So my question is not, why don't they convince you? My question is, why would you think that they're wrong?
Why would I think that they're wrong,
right,
even though that their intuition tells them that they're right?
Because your intuition tells you you're right. Their intuition tells them that they're right. You have two people who subjectively, their intuition indicates a certain truth. Dennis's intuition is that all of this is wrong. So how can we tell Dennis that he's wrong to
right.
not believe in God? If the grounding for truth is solely personal intuition, then Dennis is correct in saying that there is no God. Because his intuition leads him to believe that.
We're also correct in saying that there is.
No, it's not that both are correct. No, the one thing that most of us forget in talking about this, and Stephen Tallman does this in his The Use of Argument. Everybody should read it. In my personal humble opinion, it's the Bible of argumentation.
What is it? What's it called?
It's called The Use of Arguments.
By who?
By Stephen Tallman, T-O-U-L-M-I-N. I think Stephen is with a PH, as I recall, isn't it?
Yeah. I don't know. I'm not familiar with his work.
He is brilliant because the one thing that he brings into all of this is that you have to, of course, have warrant. You have to have all of this basis. But you have to be able to analyze one thing, the probability of your position being true.
Right.
In other words, the degree of which is most people don't do when they're debating. It's usually just black or white. I'm right, you're wrong. What this type of approach does is it recognizes that, A, we are fallible, finite human beings with limited knowledge. And each of us, ostensibly, hopefully, is doing the best we can with what we have. So he can say, based on the information he has, part of which is what he has intuited to be true, can say, I believe you're wrong. My certitude on this is X, though. It's not that I'm saying I know you're wrong, because then that would make him a Gnostic theist, i.e., he's Moses. He's talked to God. He hasn't, that I know of. So
not yet, at least.
Yeah, not yet. Maybe tomorrow, maybe tonight, but not right now. That therefore it is just based on the evidence that he has, your claim is not persuasive.
So this is a good answer, and it brings me to question two. And that's how we talk about it around here. In fact, when Dennis has made exactly that same point. You can't be 100% certain. In fact, he is rightfully critical of Christians who are like, I know for a fact that this is true. And he says, how can you know anything for 100%? Is it even possible you're wrong? Well, of course it's possible that you're wrong. So what we talk about is more plausibly true than false. When we hold our standard of argumentation, we want our premises to be more plausibly true than false. It'll yield us a conclusion that's more plausibly true than false. You held up today, though, in your presentation, a different standard, beyond reasonable doubt. So if the Christian has to prove Messiah is Yeshua beyond reasonable doubt, that doesn't square with your own standards for Torah and for argumentation with other people. So why hold the Christian Messiah to beyond a reasonable doubt if plausible is at your actual standard?
I don't think Asher was in his presentation is holding Christians beyond a reasonable doubt. He has already acknowledged that he himself can make the argument that Christianity is true and that Jesus is the Messiah. And my hunch is he could probably do it better than many Christians just because of his knowledge both of Judaism and Christianity.
Right.
So he's acknowledged that it's reasonable. However, based on Judaism, which is what he's evaluating it from, that's the standard by which the evaluation is taking place, that argument isn't credible. That's the issue. Now, if you take that away, then it's a no-holds-barred sort of situation. So he's not quite doing that. I would argue he's doing the exact same thing.
And I will yield the floor to the lawyer.
Yeah, I guess I was just going to follow up on some of the points that you were making, Scott. It seems to me that the standard shouldn't be the intuition standard by any stretch of the imagination, right? It should be what is reasonable, what's the most reasonable conclusion given all the alternatives that we have. And I think the other thing, not only do we need to do that, and we need to apply a similar standard across, you know, as we evaluate each system, whether it be Judaism, Christianity, Hinduism, atheism, agnosticism, etc. I think the most difficult thing for almost all of us as human beings is to disconnect our rational function from our emotional function. And I'll cite one example that some of you have heard before. I tried a murder case in Hawaii, and it came back to the hung jury. There were eight people who voted to acquit the person. It was a self-defense case, first of all. Second of all, this case is on video. So you actually have video of exactly what happens. You see the guy who does the shooting gets beat on the ground multiple times before he, and he's a law enforcement officer, before he finally draws his weapon and shoots and kills the individual. Eight people voted to acquit voting self-defense. Four people voted for Dill. And it was interesting, as we talked to several of the jurors from the group of eight who voted to acquit afterward, we said, you know, what the four holdouts, what was it for them? And they said they refused to deliberate with us. They said, we don't have to talk about the facts with you. It doesn't matter. He's just guilty. He's just guilty. He's just guilty. Now, there was a huge racial aspect to this trial. The shooter was one race. The victim, the person killed, was another race. So there was a huge racial component. So even though you had objective video, even though you had witnesses for the prosecution who clearly were lying, right? They had said one thing in the grand jury testimony, they said another thing on the trial, and we put both testimonies against each other so the jurors could see that they're just out and out changing their story to try to get a conviction. People will still go back to emotional connections and base decisions off of that. And again, that's just I just throw that as a comment for all of us, that it's so hard for us to truly live by what is the most reasonable conclusion to come to, because we all come with these emotional biases, whether it be the way we were raised or we were offended by someone who held a certain position, whatever. And I think that's just, for each and every one of us, we've really got to step back and take that into deep consideration and analyze ourselves at a deep level.
We're witnessing that in Baltimore.
Yeah, right, good point.
Any of the 12 jurors who disputed that the police officer had actually shot and killed the person?
No one disputed that.
So there are things based on the evidence that all of us can agree to,
right?
That all of us can know for certain, and it's just, what is the evidence? So for example, Jesus either died and rose from the dead, or he did not die and rose from the dead. There's no middle ground in there.
Yeah, and let's hold it for 1 second, and then that, because this is something that I'm sure we'll also get to, especially in week three. Go ahead, Matt.
Well, I think what you were saying about Tallman is more used in traditional apologetics, and it's called abductive reasoning, which you have, you know, obviously inductive and deductive, but this abductive reasoning is reasoning the best explanation, and I think, you know, fits exactly with what we're talking about here. It's not necessarily that you have a definitive nature, but it is the fact that if you back it up with this, it's more plausible than not. But anyway, I guess my question, going back to kind of the theology aspect or the Judaism aspect, Paul references typology, or he references Christology, which basically says there's a shadow of not everything in of Jesus in the Old Testament. How does current Judaism or rabbinic scholarship address typology? Is there any such thing? Because I think what you referenced in your three examples were, to my explanation, kind of cherry picking and saying, look, I can refute this, I can pull the pins out of that. But if you look at it in the tapestry or in the vast expanse, there's so much more. Does that resonate at all with the scholarship?
Well, we're going to do some of this next week, but it kind of works like this. If you only had the Hebrew Bible alone with no New Testament, you won't come up with anything remotely close to either Judaism or Christianity. You won't. There's no mention of Messiah anywhere, and like, or dying for your sins or anything throughout the Torah. There's no mention of anywhere of any place of a person dying for your sins and throughout the prophets or any of this stuff. And you won't come up with Judaism or Christianity. You won't come up with vicarious atonement except for animals and so on. You won't have any of that. Any.
Well, what about Isaac? What about the sacrifice of
Right, but the only reason why you see that's a type is because the New Testament comes in and tells you,
and
it's using it as a type and shadow.
So maybe
it's
I will
mention.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, I'm just saying, obviously I understand how Christianity would see this as a type for Jesus' atoning sacrifice. If you were to look just at the text of Isaac alone, is the concept of atonement there? Does it say kapara, which is the Hebrew word for atonement? No, it does not. Does it use any of the words that would have been used at that time for sin sacrifice? No, it does not. It does not use chet, it does not use asham, it doesn't use any of this. In fact, that whole thing happens from Moses' time on. So all of the notion that you have of vicarious atonement is a late thing. If I'm just looking at it chronologically, here we have Abraham and Isaac, and then we have Moses in the 1300s BC. Wow, where do you think this is even atonement? Why are you even... So this is looking back into it, which is, what do we call that? Eisegesis. If you look at the text alone, he's correct. No Messiah. You'll be hard-pressed looking in the Torah for life after death. Even in the prophets, you probably won't find it until you get to what we in the Hebrew Bible call the writings. So no life after death, no atoning sacrifice, no Messiah, yet Jews believe there is.
Yeah, because it's the number 13th there, and we believe that life after death is mentioned in the Torah and all of those types of things.
Which is to say, eisegetical reading is not necessarily wrong. It's just, it's less immediately obviously true than exegetical reading.
Yeah, or maybe another way
it
to put it.
It requires hidden premises.
If I just have the Asher does this example all the time. If I were to give the U.S. Declaration of Independence, the Declaration of Independence, to somebody who knew English and had a nice little student dictionary, Merriam-Webster student dictionary, and I were to ask them, so what does it mean, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness in this one document? And they looked up the word, well, let's see, pursue, chase after, happiness, be happy. Will they get what was intended by the authors of the U.S. Declaration of Independence? Both Asher and I would submit to you, fat chance, ain't going to happen. It will not be there. Why? Well, because the person who wrote this text did not include that context. And context, while Asher last week talked about the 20-20 rule, 20 verses before, 20 verses after, that's small C context. This is the big C context. The only way they would understand what the Declaration of Independence meant would be to find out, one, who wrote it? Oh, Thomas Jefferson, a whole group of people. Read the Federalist Papers. Not only that, find out who John Locke is. And then at that point, they'll go, oh, pursuit of happiness means right to property ownership, tangible material. Now I get it. But if I went right now to, in fact, you heard in the last election when Mitt Romney, who's gone to law school, said, pursuit of happiness is the right to be happy. That's what he said to the public. Now, hopefully he wouldn't have done that on a test in law school. That was just for pavlum for us. But that's what the masses probably think it means without any education. And that's the problem with the text.
And this point should resonate, because we make this point in this class frequently, that kind of context, cultural context, as an example, is very important. Yes, Dennis.
I wanted to defend myself against you earlier. At one time, I agreed with the cosmological argument. Since then, you know, I have, in emails, gone the other way. It's not just I changed my mind whenever I feel like it.
No, maybe I misunderstood. I thought you accepted the premises and the conclusion, but that you said it's implications of timeless places and material, blah, 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 that you don't accept those.
No.
Okay.
And I have defended that in emails to you, but I wanted to bring up a point with you guys. You said that the people in Canaan, whoever, the tights, this tight, that tight, the sacrifice of children was a bad thing. Well, what was Abraham going to do to Isaac? Regardless of whether it was for atonement or what, he was going to cut his throat and burn him up.
Right, so that's what I said last week, that it referred to, see, I have my prophetic skills
you
available.
You were good. He got the bug here.
So that's why I was saying last week that God, when he communicated, and at least in the text, we don't have any background because the text itself doesn't say, but here's he's a Christian scholar. His name is H. Clay Trumbull. This is the definitive text. It's cited all over academic sources everywhere, and this thing was written in, I believe, the early 1900s, late 1800s, and still today is used as the definitive text on studying about blood covenant and covenant cultures all around the world. This guy, without having Google or nothing, just was incredible. So he cites all throughout this book about covenant culture and people understanding what's going on in a covenant culture or a blood-related culture. Say, for example, if Scott and I shake hands, he'll point out in this book, him and I are covenant-making. But we don't have that context. We just shook hands. We didn't make a covenant. Him and I didn't make a covenant today when we did that. But at one time, people cut their hands, they shook hands, and they made a covenant with each other. So for the hearers of this, That makes sense. So for an ancient Israelite culture or ancient Middle Eastern culture, this kind of stuff makes sense when God commands Abraham to come and bring his son Isaac for a sacrifice, and he goes, okay, not a problem, and he's ready to do it because of covenant culture. That's why.
Well, so why is that different than a whatever type sacrificing children? Why is it?
Why is one wrong and the other? Why is one wrong and the other one right? Why is it okay to sacrifice children to Molech, but it's not okay to sacrifice children to God?
Right. So in the text itself, it starts to spell out why does God stop Abraham from doing it? To demonstrate two things. One is of course, Abraham being obedient. The second one is you don't need to do this kind of stuff. Right. And you'll see throughout the Torah text itself and the prophets, don't be sacrificing humans. In fact, that's one of the big contentions that you'll see with counter-missionary Jews and Christians. They'll go, well, hey, you know, Jews crucified Jesus and the Romans crucified Jesus, and here it is, you have a human sacrifice. God doesn't accept human sacrifices, so this is silly types of business.
But Abraham was going to do it. He was within inches of doing it. So it doesn't matter what God did afterwards. He was going to do it.
And Abraham also, at least the text alludes to, is either A, he knew that it was going to stop, or B, that Isaac was going to be resurrected from this, because God already made a promise to him.
Right. And this, remember, last week when you asked the exact same question, our answer was the exact same one, and I'll tack on my exact same answer too. Do you think that it's material that God had already promised that Isaac would live and that he would have children? Is that material to your calculus at all?
Well, you reading something into that, it said that future generations will be counted. And this one thing is that they'll be named after you. It doesn't necessarily mean that he's going to survive. And
I'll defer to the experts on this one, but I think that the standard contextual reading of that is that Isaac will be the father of the promise, meaning he has to have natural-born children for this to work. So if that's the way Abraham understood it, let's pretend that that's the way that Abraham understood it. Would that make a difference to you?
Then why did he sort of object? You know, doesn't he say to God, do I really have to do this? Is this necessary?
I don't recall that.
Not that I know.
But he was going to do it. Yeah.
Jesus asked that question.
The dude was going to do it.
Yeah. And the question is, does it matter?
Forget that. My other point is, you guys realize that your position and these guys' positions are everlastingly mutually exclusive. You're never going to convince these people to be a Jew, and they're never going to convince you to be a Christian. It's not going to happen.
I do not concede your point.
Right. First of all, that can't even be true, because Asher has gone through multiple positions in his own personal
right.
Right? They contradict exactly what you just said, Dennis.
But where he's at now, it's not going to happen.
Dennis, the whole point of counter-missionaries is that people, Christians and cults, came to Judaism, went to the edge of the flock, stole those people, and the counter-missionaries went back and changed their mind. That's what these gentlemen do, and I won't put them on the spot to ask them, but I'll bet you they have done exactly what you're doing. And if you think that there aren't Jews that have become Christians, you'll have to talk to the Jew that became a Christian who's sitting right in front of you.
Oh, he's not a Jew.
Not anymore.
And if the definition changes, then... But that's patently false.
One other note. I think that in general, and I Asher introduced me to Alistair McGrath, who I dearly love. If I could only have the British accent.
I know. Just, it works in his favor.
It's so pleasant to listen to. He's like, whatever you're saying, yes. Is this. Apologetics, first and foremost, is to show I'm not insane for believing what I believe. And I'm going to present arguments that are reasonable and rational, such that while you may not be ultimately persuaded by them, you will end up assuming you're rational and reasonable to go, you know, Asher's not insane for being an Orthodox Jew. I may not agree with him, but he's not crazy. And that, I think, that is the first and foremost purpose of apologetics. So for the Christians here, like I said, Asher can present a reasoned argument for Christianity. He is not ultimately persuaded by it, but he can show Christians aren't crazy. And he can do the same for Jews. We're not nuts.
No, but isn't it true that Judaism traditionally is not a proselytizing religion?
Actually, traditionally, during the time of the Second Temple period and before, it was.
I mean now.
Yeah, and now it is not. But that's because of the persecution that went on in Europe.
You reign in the missionaries when people are trying to burn your whole ghetto.
Even before,
that's not possibly true.
I mean, the fact that you're here,
you're here talking to us, trying to convince us that we're wrong.
Well, I mean, Dennis, that's not what they're saying. What they mean to say is.
I said, of course, you two are trying to do that. But on the whole, Judaism does not try to do that. Because when I converted,
Modern Judaism has been less concerned with that than ancient, than 0 CE plus Judaism was. It's mentioned in the New
Testament. I'm curious about why you're doing that.
Jesus mentions it in the New Testament. He criticizes the Pharisees and says, you will travel to the ends of the earth. That's how seriously missionary they were. They were sending people out to the ends of the earth. And everywhere that Paul went, everywhere he went, there was a synagogue. Everywhere that he went, that was the first place he went, and it indicated that the Jews had left Palestine, gone to all portions of the Roman Empire, and successfully made converts to Judaism, including in Rome itself, because that's to whom the Book of Romans was written.
I was just saying modern Judaism, Doug. I just wondered why you guys are doing this.
Oh. Well, wouldn't you say that first and foremost, why would we be willing to have a discussion like this with people who are not Jewish? I mean, practicing Jews.
Oh, well, for starters,
these non-practicing.
Yeah. Well, for starters, I see Christians as being my brothers and sisters. Anyway, so I'll give you a good example. I watched a debate between theists and atheists. Who did I see on the theist side? I was shocked. So we have William Lane Craig was there, and a bunch of others. And we got a whole bunch of others. There was a conservative rabbi.
He's a favorite of the class and the bane of Dennis.
Yeah. There was a conservative rabbi on the side of the theist. Him and William Lane Craig and all these together got together, and they formed their arguments against the atheist.
Who were the atheists?
Christopher Hitchens. I'm not sure. The video's up on YouTube. Yeah. But I can tell you about the Alistair McGrath conversation. Richard Dawkins was making a video where he's traveling around doing all this kind of stuff. It's funny.
I saw that.
You saw it?
Yeah.
Did you see his conversation with Alistair McGrath? Because they cut it out of the DVD, shockingly as it is. But guess what? They put it up on YouTube for everybody to see, thank God. And so where Alistair McGrath and Richard Dawkins are having this conversation, and Richard Dawkins had to admit, yes, science only goes so far, and yes, it's reasonable to be a Christian. And Alistair McGrath also likewise said, hey, you know, you're right, science only goes far, and the reason why I'm a Christian is because Christianity best makes sense out of the world in which I live. He said that verbatim. You can go listen to him say it. And he goes, so that's my position, and I enjoy dialoguing with people of other faiths because I learn things about myself, I learn things about them, and so on. So I'm kind of like, I said, you know, I want to be the Alistair McGrath of Judaism. And I have no fear in dialoguing with my friend Scott or anybody else and, you know, having this. I may disagree with them or whatever have you, but that's fine. I see him as my brother or Sarah as my sister or whatever. And it's no problem like that. So.
My hero as an atheist is Christopher Hitchens. Real man.
What did he say?
His hero as an atheist is Christopher Hitchens.
Oh, Christopher. I like Christopher Hitchens a lot.
He was awesome.
Very eloquent.
Yes, he was.
Seriously mistaken.
Got William Lane Craig called him a rhetorical genius.
That's true. So is Hitler. Go ahead, guy.
Yes, he was, and he was very successful.
Right.
You had mentioned context earlier. You have to understand different phrases within context. I was thinking about the Apostle Paul. He had written arguably 2/3 of the New Testament, somewhere around there. And he used in Acts 17 and 18, he uses reason and reasoning from the Old Testament scriptures as his primary method of converting people to Christianity. Since Paul was trained by Gamaliel and he was a Pharisee, would it be reasonable for us to assume that he understand both culture and context when he was making these claims that Jesus was in fact the Messiah?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I have no problem with that. In fact, there's a book I think it's called Paul the Pharisee, written by Brad Young.
Oh, Brad Young.
Written by Brad Young, and there's another guy. Tim Haig, who is a Jew that had converted to Christianity, and he has a book called Paul the Letter Writer. And he's published in peer-reviewed journals and so on. And he notes that Paul's letters, we have some of Gamaliel's quote-unquote letters in the Talmud. And that Paul starts his letters, and his teacher, Gamaliel, start their letters the same way. So this is one of the ways that you can go, this guy actually learned from this guy, Gamaliel, and so on. And so, I mean, I thank Messianic Jews all the time for this. It's like looking at, you know, the Jewish or Pharisaic or rabbinic nature, whatever term that you want to use for the letters of Paul. And I would submit to you that it's typical Pharisaic Judaism that he's writing. Of course, there's going to be, if you want the academic in me to come out, I would go, well, there seems to be some interpolations in there. In other words, you'll be following something that Paul is saying, then all of a sudden it looks like it goes off on a tangent and comes back and goes here. So maybe it's an interpolation, maybe it's not. Because you can say the same thing about the Hebrew Bible too.
Right.
You know, you shall not cook a kid in its mother's milk is found three times in the Torah, and it has no context whatsoever sitting right there in the text. So it's reasonable to believe that.
Yeah, it would be helpful if we had the other side of the conversation. You know, he's writing these letters to other people, and then he goes off on this tangent, obviously addressing something that they had maybe talked about or they had written to him previously. That'd be helpful.
Let me ask a follow-up question so you can kind of understand where he's coming from. Do you believe, based on a Pharisaic, if Paul is the Pharisee that he claims,
yeah,
and if he is using a Pharisaic worldview to analyze the claims of Jesus,
yeah,
would you come up with the Jesus of mainstream Christianity using that understanding and context?
No.
That's the key.
Right.
That's actually one of the dilemmas in this issue, is he, and I agree with him 100%, he has no problem in acknowledging that Paul is using Pharisaic ideas and Pharisaic approach. One, if you strip the Pharisaic approach out of the Bible, you'll never end up with Christianity. You'll never end up with Judaism. And any academic will laugh at both Christianity and Judaism for their misinterpretation of the Bible. And they would be right to do that. Number two, if it is Pharisaic, you don't end up with modern mainstream Christianity, as he just noted.
Which I actually think is, now allow me to twist that point, if you will, I think is very compelling. Because what it says is, why would a guy who is so clearly adhering to the law that he's stoning early Christians and overseeing, in accordance with both Torah and tradition, what you ought to do to somebody who either claims to be God or is a blasphemer, all this, absolutely. What would change a student of Gamaliel's mind that much? Part of the Christian calculus would be, sounds like his claim of having an authentic interview, so to speak, with God, Mosaic in some ways, might be that thing that flipped him from that which we would expect to that which we don't expect. So asking the Bayesian question of why would we have the evidence that we do absent this particular idea. But I think
that's good. I think that's going in the direction.
So that why do you, maybe, and let me go with that, holding that idea out there as you know, that's one. Let me take it back to the central claim of Christianity, which I really have two major questions that I'd like to ask you. I guess I'll ask them both now, but you don't have to answer them here. If you want to research them and answer them week three, too, that gives you some time to
look
through.
It's going to be a big one.
That's right. You better sit down.
It'll be two big ones. One,
it's going to be BS.
If you go back to we have used on occasion what Craig uses on occasion, kind of the Habermas minimal facts approach to the resurrection. So question one is, what is the Jewish explanation of the five facts of the resurrection with which you're familiar, so I won't, and the classes too, so I won't waste time on that one. And really, when we go to the Old Testament, what I'd love to hear you talk to, and I see that, I know the guys on the internet may bring those up, the three scriptures you brought up, maybe more frequently. To me, I find different scriptures much more compelling.
Okay.
What do you say vis-a-vis Daniel 9? Not just with Daniel 9 as a scripture, but also the rabbinic tradition that says the Messianic age should have already, not only should have already begun, we're in it now, and Messiah should have come. Daniel's Messiah, whether version 1, version 2, or version both, should have come Second Temple, you know, and what does the back end of Daniel 9 mean? So I know that's a big question, so I don't want to throw that on you to do now. But ultimately, those are ones that we would like to hear answered.
Sure. So let me start with the Daniel one first. So if you look in commentaries, regardless of whether it's Christian or Jewish, so forget the academics, just Christian or Jewish, everybody comes up with different timelines.
Right.
There's no one agreed standard on Daniel 9 on what the timeline is and how everything is mapped out, what the 70 weeks is, what these 7 weeks are, and so on and so on. Nobody agrees. So that already demonstrates the ambiguity almost of the text.
Yes.
But I like what he did. He goes, well, hey, let's go into rabbinic literature. He's right. It is clear. In rabbinic literature, it does state that the Messiah is supposed to come during the Second Temple period. We believe that. In fact, I can show you rabbinic literature that says that the Messiah was supposed to come during the time of King Hezekiah. And the Messiah was supposed to come even before, I'll tell you who, King Cyrus. There's places in rabbinic literature that said that God was so angry with the Israelites or Jewish people that the reason why he calls Cyrus, King Cyrus, the Persian king, his anointed. He even uses that term, my anointed, his anointed. It's because he wanted to strip the Israelites and the Jews of all of their ability and so on, and he wanted to make him. You can see, that's what it says in rabbinic literature. An example would be like this. Correct me if I'm wrong. I haven't slept, that's why. I have insomnia sometimes, so sometimes it's very difficult for me to sleep. So it's either Abraham or Moses where God pulls him aside and says, you know what, forget these people. I'm going to take you and I'm going to make a great nation of you. Right. I believe it's Moses that he says this. So we already have this model of God going, hey, I'm going to do this. Well, Moses says, no, please don't do that. You know, look, I know they're all messed up, but I'm going to do whatever. So we do have in rabbinic literature, you know, regarding King Cyrus, God was thinking of doing this with King Cyrus. And as he pointed out, yes, we do have places in rabbinic literature that says at the very least, he's supposed to come during the Second Temple period. We also have another statement, too. We have a Jewish timeline that's built up into 2,000-year increments. And there's an allotted time, I can't remember what it is.
2,000 years from creation to Moses, 2,000 years from Moses to the beginning of the Messianic period, 2,000 years from there to potentially.
And so on. So there is a cap on when the Messiah has to come. We have that in our own beliefs anyway. So even if mankind is doing great or they're, you know, so messed up, we already believe that the Messiah is coming at a certain time. So
depending on the tradition, so that folks know as well, and this speaks to stuff you have to know where a lot of the New Testament doesn't make sense. If there was rabbinic tradition that said if the nation of Israel is being righteous and doing the right thing, he will come on the clouds in conquest. And if they're not, he will come meek and lowly riding on a donkey.
That's correct.
So that, if you're wondering where that comes from, it's actually ancient rabbinic tradition, which is interpretation of the Old Testament scriptures.
So we would say it's possible, that's why we have that joke. Is it your first time in Jerusalem? So it's possible that Jesus is the Messiah. It's also possible that there's other messianic claimants during the same time period as the Second Temple period. I think it's Professor Raphael Patai who has a whole list of Messiah claimants both from before Jesus all the way up until current times. In fact, there's another book called From Jesus to Crown Heights or something. It is another one.
That's a good title.
And where they, you know, they list basically Messiah claimants. So it's possible that during the Second Temple period, it was Jesus or another person. There's a couple of people who I can't remember the names at the moment. But
well, you laid out the possibilities, but you didn't answer the question, which is, why don't you think that Messiah had to come by the end of the Second Temple, but before the destruction?
Oh, no.
Temple.
We believe that
he should have.
He should have, or he did.
Issue.
Right.
He also should have come during King Hezekiah's time. He should have come during Cyrus's time.
So you don't see it as failure of prophecy that Messiah failed to show up?
No, it's us who failed.
Okay, all right. A contingent prophecy.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I was just going to ask, kind of, it might be in the same vein as the who's the Antichrist, where you don't have an answer, and that's fine. But so would you just if you had to make a choice, would you say that the Messiah already came and we missed it, we don't know who it is, but there's not enough evidence to say it's Jesus, or that the Messiah hasn't come yet? It's just if you had to decide, like...
So do you believe the Messiah has come or not?
So we don't believe that the Messiah has come. But I don't know that, but I don't believe that he has come.
So the greater than 50% says...
Yeah, so the coup de grace will be this. What you guys claim is that Jesus is going to do in the second coming, whether you're an atheist, a Jew, a Buddhist, a Hindu, or whatever, it doesn't matter. Everybody's going to go, let's just pretend it's Jesus. Jesus is the Messiah. Nobody will be able to doubt it, right? That's what you believe, that when Jesus comes during the second time. In fact, when I was arguing with my friend Pauline Wamoto, I was telling him, so... Me living in New York before, and Los Angeles, and Washington, D.C., I can go outside of the White House right now, and there's a person who blows a shofar. It's called a ram's horn. He's blowing a shofar, and he says he's Jesus. And so that's what he claims. So I asked him, I said, hey, this is when I was a Zen Buddhist naysayer, the whole thing, and I was going, so all these people, you know, that I see claim to be Jesus in the streets in Los Angeles, New York, D.C., and so on. How are we going to know that Jesus... who is the real Jesus? He said, you're going to know by his acts and his power and everything, all the attributes that you will see that the Messiah is supposed to have, you're going to see it. This guy that's blowing his shofar horn, he doesn't have those. So, you know, you can have a person who claims to be the president of the United States, but if he doesn't have the Secret Service with him and he's not exiting and entering from the White House and so on, likely he's not, just like the Pope. There's a Pope that's sitting, and I think it's in Missouri. Yeah, he believes that he's the authentic Catholic Pope. He has all of it, you know, the pomp and ceremony and everything. And I mean, it's down to the T. But he's not the one who's meeting with President Obama right now regarding, you know, what's going on in Cuba and all this kind of stuff. So I'm sorry, he's not the Pope.
It's the old wisdom of a funny hat does not a Pope make.
And one other thing. In Judaism, we believe that the Messiah or a potential Messiah is born in every generation. Whether that potential Messiah becomes actualized or not is a different issue. Because in part, as Asher mentioned last time, Jews believe in reincarnation. And so that the soul of Messiah is born again in each generation, whether we're ready for it or not, oh well. But that may mean that it's in potentia and never actualized. So,
Dennis?
What do you have to... I hope that I'm around when this... Jesus comes a second time, because that's gonna outdo Godzilla and just, you know, fantastic spectacle. Oh, I will be then.
Well, actually, you will get to see it in both traditions. Whether they're right, we're right, assuming we're not both wrong, the dead will be raised.
I just want to be around.
And you will be around.
I'll be around.
Now,
do you think, this is my question.
Okay. I have a follow-up for you after your question.
Okay, do you agree with those critics of Christianity who say that the religion was literally invented by Paul?
I don't believe that.
Okay.
Yeah. I know of people who do say that. They say Jesus was actually a Torah observant Jew, believed in you know, Pharisaic Judaism and so on. Paul, he's the bad guy. He's the one who created Christianity. I find that faulty. I don't buy it. But there are people, my people, who do believe that, and they teach that and so on, and I disagree with
that. I just wondered how you felt about that.
Carl.
Just want to add one point of clarification, Asher, to what you said, that, you know, according to Christians, you know, when Jesus comes back, it's going to be obvious. I think we also have within the book of Matthew that there's going to be a lot of confusion, right? It says, and at that time, if anyone says to you, look, here's the Messiah, or there he is, do not believe it. For false messiahs and false prophets will appear and perform great signs and wonders to deceive, if possible, even the elect. So, I mean, even within the New Testament, we believe that, yes, there will be a time where ultimately it's clear that the Messiah has returned, but there will be much confusion and many people will be deceived about who the true Messiah is.
Well, I'll tell you this. In rabbinic literature, I'll have to find where it is. He was there when I was asking my teacher. He's known as the Rosh Kollel. He's the head of, like, the yeshiva and stuff. So I asked him, I said, so when the Messiah comes, I hear of Christians talking about that even this false Messiah is going to deceive even the elect and stuff like that. And usually, would you interpret the elect as being some of the Christians?
Yeah, the idea would be the elect are the quote-unquote true Christians.
Okay. Yeah. So,
if,
I mean, that's
how... It says if it were possible, and it implies that that is not a possibility.
So that's how powerful this person is, right? His persuasive skills. So in rabbinic literature, we even have that there's going to be a segment of Jews that's going to fight against the true Messiah. Let's just say that it's not Jesus at the moment, but the true Messiah comes, and Effie and I are like, no, he's false, and we go to fight against him, and there will be basically a civil war amongst the Jewish people regarding who really is and isn't the Messiah. So we have that kind of notion,
okay,
too.
Okay, sounds a lot like what happened a couple thousand years ago.
And continue to happen. You should have seen the problems we had with Shabtai Tzvi and what we did to each other.
That's right.
Jesus was nothing in comparison as far as what happened internally to the community. It was a disaster.
I'm curious on how you compare like a Hani Hamagel and the other miracle workers, how you compare them to the Jews. I'm curious on your thoughts.
So the different kind of miracle workers?
Yeah, yeah. You mentioned in the Talmud and comparing them to Jesus.
Right.
And his miracles and so on.
Right.
So I see a lot of equivalence, at least. So I'll give you an example. In one place...
We got five more minutes, so we'll give you guys the last 5 minutes to say whatever you want, and then we'll go next time, too.
Okay. Like, there's a place in the New Testament where it says that Jesus spit into the ground, and he made clay, and he put it in the person's eyes, and the person's, his sight was, you know, healed, right? You know where you find this? It's in rabbinic literature. That even the power of the Messiah's spit, his spittle, will have healing properties. So, don't get me wrong, you will see people of my classmates and stuff like this, who will be like, no, Jesus, his miracles aren't really anything or nothing. In fact, what you'll see, like Moses and his, you know, miracles that he did through the power, you know, with the power of God and everything. Who's the second person who did Moses-like miracles?
Of course, the priest.
The next guy, Joshua.
Oh, yeah.
Joshua goes.
But also the Pharaoh's priests were able to do some of that, too.
Yeah, but Joshua is the very next person who comes, just like, you know.
The river.
So there's this equivalence. So I find equivalent type miracle, you know, business happening in rabbinic literature as that is the New Testament and so on. So when I first learned of it, it was actually from a guy named Pastor Alan Landry. And I was like, whoa, he talked about even the spittle will do this. And this was part of context. So why did Jesus do that? And why did the audience go, oh, because it's rabbinic Pharisaic Jews looking at this and going, because you don't find that statement in the Hebrew Bible, in the Old Testament. You don't find that anywhere. So he's doing miracles that they relate to and stuff like that. We talked about this last week where, like I said, that we believe in reincarnation. And part of that reincarnation kind of goes like this. I could be reincarnated, let's say that I pass away, I come back, and I could be reincarnated in an inanimate object, a rock, or a tree, or an animal, or a human being, whether male or female, and so on. Well, there's a place in the New Testament where Jesus says, even if these rocks could cry out, you already see an idea of reincarnation in the New Testament. I'm not telling you that it's true, but that's definitely the belief, because the belief at the time period, there's multiple places in the New Testament where you will see Jesus encountering people and they believe, he's talking to them about their belief. They believe in reincarnation. Here's an example where he's given that, hey, if even these rocks could cry out, they would proclaim so and so. The people are going, the rocks.
You gave the better one, which was, Rabbi, was it this man's sin or his parents' sin that he was caused to be born blind? But why would this man's sin be the cause of his being born blind unless he was guilty prior to being born is the implication there. Whether Jesus was trying to say that's true, or alternately, whether he was talking, whether it was merely an expression of the... In fact, it was the apostles that said it. But if the apostles were expressing exactly this idea, which reinforces the idea that, which can be found in the literature, you don't need the apostles speaking for this one, but the context in which they were speaking was one that expected reincarnation to be a real thing.
And Jesus refuted them by saying, neither?
Well, it wasn't a refutation specifically of the doctrine of reincarnation, but he did remove that as a justification for reincarnation by saying it was not this man's sin. Now, whether that was meant to say reincarnation isn't false, it doesn't speak to that.
Right. He didn't affirm or deny it. He just said, hey, the reason why this guy was born this way is for the glory of God.
Right.
This reincarnation, I want to come back as my dog. He lives a life of
That's a good point.
It was a quick little practical question. If you came back as a rock, wouldn't you be stuck there? Like, wouldn't you never die again? And then
have you seen the rocks that move in the?
That's the worst part.
What was that, frozen?
So I have a feeling that I'm going to come back as a rock and drift the glacier and nothing happens,
right?
No, so the belief in rabbinic Judaism kind of goes like this. Let's say that I come back as a tree. We have a Hebrew term, it's called tikkun, and it means like repair or to rectify or whatever. So let's say that I came back as a tree, I got cut down, and that door right there, which is made out of wood, my soul is in that wood, and I just heard the Bible, the words, whatever, and God will decide if that was what I needed to come in here, and then I would be taken away and everything would be okie dokie. It could be that I was a tree and I got, you know, cut down, and that at that point, that's when I rectified things. It could be a whole number of things. Maybe it was a fly on the wall and it heard a conversation, and that was that. I'll give you a really short story. There's a famous Kabbalistic rabbi named the Arizal, and there were two people in his town. This woman, her husband had passed away, and she had just had a baby from him. And so the baby was presented to have his circumcision done, and on the eighth day. And so after the baby's circumcision, a day later, the baby died. And they're like, what is this? I'm fulfilling the commandments of the law. How could God do this to me? So she goes to this rabbi, the Arizal, and she asks, what's going on? And so he, this is what we believe in rabbinic Judaism, is that, and this idea of reincarnation, oh, this was your grandfather who refused to circumcise his children. He has come back again. He has now fulfilled being circumcised, and he has now returned, you know, he's now gone on to heaven, and so on and so on. So he only came back to fulfill actually the one thing that he didn't have done. So it's that kind of an idea.
Are you telling me that I could come back as a fly on the wall and listen to Scott and I'm saved? Is that what you were saying?
I don't think that he would be saying that exactly, but he's making the point of maybe you came back as a fly on the wall and you listened to him and were saved.
Seriously, you come back as a tree and you cut down, you're part of that door, and you hear, this is really weird stuff.
Well, hey, I can pick up atheist magazines, right? Scientific journals and stuff, and they are talking all about... You talked about the weirdness of this. So the weirdness of this is this. So I can bring them in. I'll bring them in next week because I love collecting these things, all about aliens coming to the planet and how they're going to administer the world with kindness and this and that. And the only thing... And they're pontificating about all of this. Well, how the aliens are going to do this, when they're going to do this, why they're going to do this. They even said that the aliens aren't going to have any type of religion or anything like that. And here's my thing. So, and these are top people who are teaching at our universities in England, the United States, and so on. And here's my thing. Boy, this is a bunch of craziness. Where's the evidence for aliens? Why are they doing this stuff? Why do they believe this silly
stuff? Science fiction, that's not science.
No. What he's talking about, Dennis, is the belief. And, I mean, go look at... Go watch.
It's mainstream science right now.
Yeah,
that's what NASA is funding. All this work to identify where the why haven't we found the aliens yet? This is mainstream science. Dennis.
Looking for alien civilization does not make it up crap like this that they're going to come here. Looking for alien civilizations. That doesn't make what he said true.
That's correct.
Well, that's correct. Dennis, the point is this:
looking for alien civilizations is not crazy.
The point is these guys are speculating on what those aliens would look like. They're making a scientific prediction based on their understanding of what those guys would look like.
You gotta show me this.
And so you're right. It all sounds crazy. But hey, you know what? Talking snakes sound crazy. Talking donkeys sound crazy. Virgin births sound crazy. And that's all what Christians believe. But I don't think that they're crazy for that belief. And if somebody thinks that I'm crazy for believing in reincarnation, so what? I put this right back at them. So show us this talking snakes and the talking donkeys and ocean splitting and all of this kind of stuff. The same weirdness applies both ways. So I don't feel threatened with Christians, you know, saying something to me, or an atheist or whatever. everybody's in the same boat. So in regards to the weirdness, same thing with the atheist scientists that are pontificating about aliens coming and all this and what they're going to be like and so on. It's just silly. There's no evidence for it, right?
Show me. You're going to come next week, show me that over
there. Sure, sure.
We'll do. And remember, even the atheists believe things that are so insanely improbably true that it's like 1 in 10 to the 77th against that it could possibly happen. And yet they still believe in it. So even atheists believe that kind of stuff. That was a barb. You're supposed to get mad at me at this point. All right.
So, thank you.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. It's 12:15. Normally we would run a little longer, but since it's Mother's Day.